three things out of the way just starting this. First of all, the author's name, Anna Kavan. I've heard this name pronounced at least three different ways. Kavan, Kavan, Kavan. Oh, there's probably four or five other ways you can get out of that. I don't know which one's correct. So I'm going to try to stick with Kavan. I stick with Kavan because, first of all, this isn't really even her name. Anna Kavan is the name of a character in one of her first two novels, and she took the name of the character onto herself. And when she created that character, she created the character's name as a reference to Kafka, Franz Kafka, who the original Czech pronunciation of Kafka, K-A-F-K-A, was Kavka, K-A-V-K-A. So Kavka, Kavan. That's why I'm going with that pronunciation. So if I'm saying it wrong, sorry. Secondly, Anna Kavan, yes, she was a heroin addict. She was a heroin addict. The drugs were given to her by a doctor. It was a different time. Very different situation in some ways. She ended up dying because of that addiction. Those are important things in the story of her life. I don't think, in contradiction to almost everyone who has written about this book, I don't think it means anything in the context of this book. I read one review where they mentioned the drugs close to 20 times. There are no drugs that I can remember at all in this novel, which doesn't mean that metaphorically it could have been happening, but I didn't get any of that at all. I can see how people pull that out of it, but I think sometimes when we know something about the author's life, we try to feed in the information we know about the author and assume that in some way that's what was on the author's mind when they wrote something. You know, like somebody could be going through a divorce at that time and they write a novel and then say, oh yes, you can see the anguish of the divorce in there. Maybe. Unless the person says they did that, maybe. Maybe writing the novel was an escape and they didn't think about it at all. I don't get any of that here. I think to some degree, whatever the hardships she was going through because of addiction may have played to some degree into the tone here, but I don't think it has anything to do with the meaning. We are venturing into the first book of fiction, first of all, or for the first time, I should say. And when you enter into the world of fiction, most of your conversations can either be about a story, which I'm not going to reiterate the story here. It's not my job to give a book report. I think I said that in the last episode. You should read the book. It's also a really complicated book and a very complicated plot. So I don't even think if I tried to explain the plot to you that it would it would do much good. The other thing about the whole drug thing, it's just, I don't think it's important in, I think people feed those things in as a moralization. And I this book is so much more than something so simple. I think that people doing that are just simplifying it. This is a crazy book in a lot of ways, but it's so brilliant. It's so brilliant because it is complex. It is fragmented. Yet at the same time, it's completely compelling. Oftentimes when you pick up something with kind of an avant-garde structure, you have to force your way through it. Like if you've ever picked up David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, in many ways a brilliant book, but not, at least for me, compelling. I never made it past, I think, the first 20 pages because I just I couldn't engage with it. On the other hand, this book is completely engaging. So it's a very masterful thing that she's done here. I'm writing a novel that this is the first time I've read this book, first of all. I'm writing a novel. I've been writing it for many years before I even knew this book existed, with an avant-garde structure, but I wanted to give it the propulsion, the engagement of the reader that a book that doesn't have an avant-garde structure would. And after reading this book is going to be a huge influence on that, I think, if I ever get back to it. But one of the things about the best novels is that they start like this one does, mid-gallop. It's like you're just thrown into something. And I don't know why, but there's something really compelling as a reader to be just a little discombobulated, where you're not sure of everything that's going on. It's not just as a reader. Same with movies, too. You know, like, if you watch a movie where it's like, the character was born, and then they give you, like, a synopsis of how you got to this point where the story's going to start, it's boring. But if they throw you in the middle of a gunfight, and then you have to, like, figure out why this gunfight's going on and which character you're supposed to associate with, you're in. You are engaged with that. It's a very interesting trick. I wouldn't even say a trick. It's a very interesting piece of craft to do that. This book, it came out in 1967. And the name of the book is Ice. Ice is a big metaphor in this book. It's a post-apocalyptic world, and ice is slowly engulfing the globe. Okay, that's part of the plot. And 1967, she writes this book, and I wonder, with this metaphor of ice taking over the globe, did she read Kurt Vonnegut's 1963 novel, Cat's Cradle? Was this ice influenced by Ice Nine in that novel? In that novel, Ice Nine is this element that when it comes into contact with water, or water becomes Ice Nine, I should say, it becomes ice, but it's ice that's solid at room temperature. So it doesn't have to get cold to become solid ice. It can be solid, like at 90 degrees, we'll say. And when Ice Nine comes into contact with water, the water turns into Ice Nine. So in the novel, everything on the earth is slowly freezing because of it spreading. It's very similar in that sense. Now, the ice here is something in the background. It's not even a key plot point. I mean, she could literally have written this novel without the ice in it, and it would be pretty similar. It's more of this impending background, you know, like a love story that it's written during wartime. Well, the wartime is important because they play it into it, but really it's about the love story. It's kind of a similar situation here. Though, believe me, we are not talking about a love story here. There's a very dreamlike quality to this book. I think part of the reason you get this dreamlike quality is from a lack of specifics. In particular, this book has no proper nouns. I'm willing to say that there are zero proper nouns in this book. And if you fell asleep during English class, proper noun would be a name, a place, a person, a business. These are names, you know. There's the business. That's just a normal noun. Netflix is a proper noun. There's the guy on the bench. That's a normal noun. There's Chad. That's a proper noun. No proper nouns in this book. I'm willing to bet it was 100%. And because of that, there's a weird aloofness that you feel as a reader. The narrator has no name. Who is the narrator? We don't really know. We learn a little bit about him. It's a him. There's a girl. but she's just the girl. There's the warden. It's a title or a job. It's not a name. The places have no names. There's a hill with a name that he's heard of before, with this great view. He's heard of it. He says, I've heard the name before. Does he tell us the name of it? No. It's just the hill with the name that he's heard of before. The countries that he travels to, what are the names of them? We don't know. The towns, there's one town he refers to as the town of ruins. No names. So you're kind of floating. There's nothing to hold on to in that sense. You're swimming in this pool of reality and unreality. Kind of like the narrator. I mean, one of the questions you immediately are going to think reading this book is, what's real and what's not? We drift from situation to situation in ways that are seemingly unconnected. This girl that he's looking for, he's hunting for this girl. But she's like a mirage. He never really gets to her. And she's continually changing. Is she many different girls or is she the same girl? It's unclear. And all of these things I'm listing, these are purposeful things. These are not mistakes on the part of Kavan. This is purposeful abstraction. The narrator, he says that he takes a medication that gives him terrible dreams. And these dreams don't occur just while he's sleeping. In other words, hallucinations. So we are going from, seemingly, going from reality to maybe one of his dreams, to one of his hallucinations, to reality, to another dream, to an hallucination. But there's nothing demarking the transitions. They flow into each other like they're meant to go together. We're in his head. He says of reality, he says that it's something of an unknown quantity to him. That's a quote, something of an unknown quantity. Time, reality, identity are all unstable, or at least unclear. This girl is continually leaving or being taken away. She's continually under the control of men, which seems to insinuate some sort of repetition, some sort of cycle of abuse, that she's moving from one abuser to the next, which when I was reading it, immediately reminded me of Sylvia Plath's poem, Daddy. She says in the poem, every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face. The brute heart of a brute like you. It's a bit of sarcasm in that. She doesn't really mean that, but she's insinuating that there is an allure to brutality. The thing that draws people into the cycle. Why when you're with one abuser, you don't run and stay away from abusers forever, but jump to another. Platt's narrator leaves the abuse of her father. I use the term narrator because the poem is not necessarily told from Sylvia Plath herself's perspective. So I refer to the poem coming from a narrator perspective. But her narrator leaves the abuse of her father only to leap into the arms, the abusive arms of a husband. And I knew what to do. I made a model of you. A man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw. And I said, I do. I do. There's something else that's achieved here that by leaving out proper nouns, Kavan is also, seems to be, insinuating that this girl is every girl. Not just every girl in the story, which seems quite clear, that every girl he encounters is quote unquote the girl, but also that every girl in the world is represented in some way by this girl, and that every man is represented by every man in this book, whether it is the narrator or the warden or any other male. The husband at the beginning of the story, the painter, is he the warden? I don't know. Is he another man? These are every men. And the places have no name because the places, well, they could be anywhere. It's every place, any place. And the time that seems to move willy-nilly back and forth, because there's no linearity to the story either, seemingly. Which reminds me of another Kurt Vonnegut novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, where Billy Pilgrim is moving back and forth through time. That seems to insinuate that the time is any time, because it's not just one specific time. At one point, he imagines a visitor from another world. I think in the context of the use of word here, she doesn't mean world in the sense of another planet. I think she means from another reality. But the narrator is imagining conversing with this visitor from another world. And the visitor tells him essentially that space-time is a hallucination. So, I mean, is that also is a question? Is that what's going on here? Is reality and time and space and all of this willy-nilly because he's living within this space-time hallucination? Or is he imagining this conversation about the space-time hallucination as a way of making sense of his own hallucination? There's not really any answers in this book. There's no yes or no to that. Maybe. That's the best answer I can give. And in reading this book, I'd be shocked if you don't feel this as well. If you've read Lolita, you will likely notice a commonality between this book and Nabokov's Lolita. For example, the girl in this book, one of the incarnations of the girl, it's said that she's 21. But she's not a woman. She's a girl. She's always the girl, perpetually the girl. Kind of like in Lolita. The girl, the nymphette, is the men in this book obsessed with girls, not women. The husband, who may or may not be the warden, he binds the girl's wrists in a position over her head so that he can paint her nude body. So she's laying there nude and she has her hands over her head, and the narrator says, I was awed by her ability to hold her hands in that position until I realized that they were strung up to this man. The girl is, she's nothing but a prop. She's an object. She's not a person. The narrator himself, he sees her as fragile, ephemeral, mirage-like. To him, she's not a person to him any more than she is to this man or to the warden. She's just an idea, a feeling, a thing for him to hunt. The struggle in Lolita of Humbert to regain Lolita from Quilty, it mirrors the relationship of Kavan's narrator with the warden. He's trying to get her back from the warden the way that Humbert is trying to get Lolita back from Quilty. And the warden's a mirror image of the narrator. Is the narrator the warden? Is the warden the narrator? It's unclear. Just as in Lolita, Quilty is pretty much Humbert Humbert, and Humbert is pretty much Quilty. They're the same dude. And there's also a similarity in that these men, all of them are battling their rivals in order to control and abuse a young girl. Back in 2014, when I first read Lolita, I wrote a blog called Reading Lolita in My Living Room, which at the time I thought was very clever because it was a nod to Haruki Murakami's book about Kafka. I don't know what I was doing. In that blog, I described how Humbert Humbert's he's a literary scholar, and he uses his flowery language to actually mask what's going on in the book. And he does it really well, that to this day, when people read the book Lolita, they think it's actually a love story because they get wrapped up in his flowery language. And I don't remember the famous line, like, fire of my fire. It's like high school poetry level stuff. And everybody thinks it's like, oh, he's really in love with her. No, he's not. He's a pedophile. And if you read the book carefully and you notice that what Nabokov has done there is he's set up this surface level of an unreliable narrator that's using flowery language and describing it as love. But if you actually pay attention to the things that slip through, you can actually see the abuse. It's shocking how many people misinterpret that book. Makes me worried a little bit about literature departments in schools. This is actually strange. I'm going to quote myself here. I'm going to quote myself from 2014. The genius of Nabokov is that while Humbert is hiding his crimes, Nabokov himself is revealing them. It's easy to miss the meaning when a woman in the lodge asks Humbert, "What cat has scratched poor you?" You almost think nothing of it. But when you stop, you have to ask yourself, why does he have scratches on his arms? Did I miss something? And you need only backtrack one sentence to find the ugly truth. And this is a quote from Lolita. Thrusting my fatherly fingers deep into Lo's hair from behind, and then gently but firmly clasping them around the nape of her neck, I would lead my reluctant pet to our small home for a quick connection before dinner. When you take that part out of context, it's pretty gross, right? Thrusting my fatherly fingers, ugh, deep from behind. And then what is he doing? He's pulling her around by the nape of her neck. What's that mean? That means he has her hand on the back of her neck, underneath her skull, and he's moving her around, physically moving a young girl around. He would lead her, his pet. She's his pet. He would lead her for a quick connection. In other words, sex. But it's hidden under the language. When you look at it like that, Nabokov is being pretty obvious. But it's easy to miss that. What's happening here in Kavan's book is not hidden. The abuse is not hidden. Even the narrator himself, who talks nothing of saving this girl, he wants to find her, he has to save her. Really, all he wants is to abuse her himself. At one point, he imagines, I'm assuming it's an imagination, finding her dead body. It's a broken body. I don't know if this is supposed to have taken place after the dragon sacrifice. Yes, there's somehow a dragon in here briefly as part of a story of sacrifice. But he finds this body like it's been dropped from great height from the way it's explained. Like her neck is twisted in a way that's not natural. her bones are broken. Let me read the quote, actually. I looked particularly at one arm, on which the circular marks of teeth stood out clearly. The bones of the forearm were broken. The sharp pointed ends of bones projected at the wrist through the torn tissue. I felt I had been defrauded. I alone should have done the breaking with tender love. I was the only person entitled to inflict wounds. He finds this girl, this woman, he finds her dead body. Does he grieve? Not even for one word. He's defrauded. He's been denied the ability to do this abuse to her himself. This is our narrator. He talks at one point about the impulse to use lit cigarettes on her. And we have to wonder, is he the man? There's a man that has this, one of the girls. It's hard to say. I'm sorry. It gets difficult here. Girl, different girls, the same girl. The girl is trapped in a room at one point, and she's in this locked room, and the guy just comes in to fuck her when he feels like it. And when he starts to talk about putting lit cigarettes out on her, you start to wonder if it's the same narrator, or are we all of a sudden, have we become this other guy? Are we getting the perspective, the view of this other guy? Are we jumping narrators? There's even one part where I think it's the same guy. He's holding a gun. The narrator is facing off with him, and they look each other in the eyes. And the narrator starts to feel confused about which of them is which. Am I him or is he me? Is this guy the warden? We don't know. Maybe. But they're the same guy and they're different guys. There's no mention of grief in that sense because, once again, the girl is just an idea to him. She's not a person to him. In another part, he says, big tears fell from her eyes like icicles, like diamonds. But I was unmoved. They did not seem to me like real tears. She herself did not seem quite real. She was pale and almost transparent. The victim I used for enjoyment in my dreams. Oh, I worded that wrong. The victim I used for my own enjoyment in dreams. What I started to wonder here is, does this girl even exist? Or is she like an onion skin that he just lays over every woman that he meets? Their only value being the story that he creates around his own sadistic desires. Or to put it maybe more appropriately, is this glass girl, as she's described at one point or multiple points, is this glass girl, is she a glass to be filled? Or broken? And when we go back to this ice wall, you know, that's freezing this earth, this doomsday scenario. The earth is slowly being consumed by ice. This is the part people seem to think is the drug metaphor. The ice is her addiction. I don't buy it. But is this idea of the ice slowly consuming the earth, is this just the end game of the violence of the world of men, of human? That the violence of humans, the cruelty and the abuse of humans, where does it lead? It leads to destruction. It leads to the earth being frozen over by ice. This book was written in 1967. But from a 2020 perspective, from a modern ecological perspective, well, we can even ask if the girl is a metaphor. I say we can even ask from this perspective in the sense that it's not likely this was what she intended, but it's a worthwhile question to ask from a modern perspective. You know, we can sometimes take meaning out of a piece of art that wasn't intended by the author and still find value in that. That's kind of the beauty of art. That's what I'm insinuating here. So we can say, what if we look at the girl as a metaphor for Mother Earth and the continual subjugation of the earth by the abuse of humans? Where will that lead? To cataclysm. Powerful metaphor. The ice swallows the earth gradually. It's another way to look at it. But the ice swallowing the earth gradually is similar to the way that this girl's soul and her emotions are being swallowed gradually. And in the end, when everything is frozen over, the earth will just be this frozen ball. And this girl will just be this fragile inference of existence. What do I mean by that when I say fragile inference of existence? I mean, if you think of a person that's made of ice, they're see-through. The only thing to their shape is like the inference of the outline. Think about the cartoons when they draw someone made out of ice or they draw something invisible. It's just lines. There's no filling. It's empty. It's see-through, it's hollow. Is that what she'll be left to? She'll just be this translucent form of glass or ice, which is what we're continually told over and over again. She's continually compared to ice or glass. There's nothing to her, or almost nothing to her. If there's one thing that's clear about this book, which is an interesting thing to say about this book, it's that this book has no one meaning. All of this is just what I thought when I was reading it. Some of it could be right. Some of it could be completely wrong. All of it could be wrong. I mean, it's easy from what I said about the abuse and comparing it to Lolita. It's easy to, in some ways, to see this as a feminist novel. Though I don't know if Kavan was a feminist. It doesn't really matter. Once again, the life of an artist should not weigh too heavily into the meaning of a book, I don't think. But the thing about it is, while it may look like this is a very feminist novel, like men abuse women always, this book is more complicated than that. Not that saying that that's not complicated doesn't mean that that's not a bad thing. Don't get me wrong there. Those are all bad things or terrible things that people do to each other. But I mean that this book is more complicated in the way that it means more than one thing, and that it's not open to simple interpretation, simple in the sense of this is what it means. Like I said, it doesn't have just one meaning. It could mean that to some degree, but that's not all it means. And why do I say that? Well, for example, Kavan is a woman writing this book. Yet as the author, she doesn't rescue the girl. She doesn't raise her up. She doesn't even give her much personality or much dialogue. Like the narrator, the girl is little more than an idea to Kavan, the author. And I think that's something that she did on purpose. She did it on purpose because she didn't even choose to give us the perspective of the girl as our perspective in this book. Instead, we are thrust into the perspective of the man, of the narrator, of the one of the abusers. And in doing that, I think what Kavan was doing was implicating herself into the cycle of abuse. And by putting us into the narrator's mind, she's implicating us as well. We have to live with his thoughts. We have to see the world through his way. None of us is free from blame in the cycle of abuse. We're all implicated. This isn't a man-woman thing. This is a human-to-human thing. The narrator and the warden are not just any man. They're any person. They're us. Their cruelty, the cruelty of everything, spreads through all of us like ice over the globe.